Richard, the history of musical theatre, and I like that term better than musicals, actually, but the history of musical theatre is littered with shows that have bucked the trend, shows in which people spoke more than they sang, shows where people only sang, shows with so much music in them you didn't quite know what to call them. I mean, I remember Frank Lesser, he of Guys and Dolls, who all but took out an injunction to stop people calling his show The Most Happy Fella a folk opera, a term he loathed. And Bernstein and Sondheim with Candide and Sweeney Todd have had similar issues. Isn't it time we reevaluated the term musical and decided what it actually meant? And do we need a word to describe musical theatre?
Well, I don't think we do need a word, actually. And of course, I keep doing exactly the same as Frank Lesser, probably, and saying whatever anybody calls this show, The Go-Between, always seems to be wrong. And so I keep saying we need as many words for musical as the Eskimos have for snow, because it's developed in too many different strands and too many different directions, and yet we still have this all-encompassing word musical, which is supposed to somehow bracket Mamma Mia along with Passion, along with Street Scene, along with Candide. So it's ridiculous. But then if we did have 20 words for musical, we'd still find ourselves slotted into one of them, which might not be appropriate anyway. So I always hope, I really hope, that the audience still defy the categorisation that producers always hope that they won't. They always think that we call it a musical and they will just go. But I always hope that audiences are much more intelligent than that, much more savvy than that, and actually just want a story. Yeah. And if they get caught up in the story, they don't care who's singing what, or whether it's been 10 minutes since they last heard a song, or whether it's been 15 minutes since anybody last spoke. They're so involved in the story that actually it doesn't matter. It just is what it is.
Butterfly, from this moment unfolding, emerging a butterfly. Somewhere deep and unveiling, ascending a butterfly. And the day became brighter, the sun became sharper, the colours were clearer, the nearer I flew to her. Because she was a part of this dream, she was the whole and the soul and the heart of this dream.
You mentioned the idea of telling the story. I mean, that was obviously, for you and David Wood, the prerequisite for The Go-Between, which is a very unusual kind of story, isn't it? Because so much is unspoken, so much is about class and the way people are buttoned up and afraid to express their emotions. It's a very difficult show to take on board.
Well, it's, of course, it appeals to my sense of the ridiculous. Well, the whole sort of premise of musicals is that you can tap any character on the shoulder at any point in the story and they will reveal what they're thinking through a song.
Yeah.
That's how musicals are built. And indeed, I had a go at doing The Go-Between using that premise, that all of the characters had their moment in the spotlight, literally, and they sang what they were thinking. And actually, it was like bursting a bubble. We had no show. There was no tension. The characters didn't live and breathe, because although we're understanding their motivations, it was the absolute understanding of those motivations that went against the Hartley novel and what Hartley wanted. Because, as you say, every character in that story is completely buttoned up. And what makes the story work and what gives it its trampoline-like tension is that you don't know who knows what. That's the whole basis of everything, is not knowing who knows what. So when David and I set out on this little journey, this long journey, I said, I don't really mind if there are no songs in it whatsoever, if no one speaks at all. This is not an ego trip for a composer. What I see in The Go-Between is a blueprint for a theatrical treatment. I think the novel is so multi-layered that there is a fantastic theatrical experience waiting to happen somehow. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how that's going to be, but I want to be involved in it. I had an inkling, of course, that there would be singing involved in that, because I think that's the only way you can multi-layer things sufficiently. But we had to find a new language. We had to find a new blueprint that wasn't the old tried and tested characters sing when the emotion gets slightly too high for them to speak it.
Yeah, that's something that people like Sondheim love to subvert.
Yeah, they, absolutely. You know,
the unexpected moment where someone sings. But that is the crux, isn't it? Is in a musical, when do people sing? When do you decide when someone sings as opposed to speaking? And how much can you blur those distinctions? I mean, that show recently, London Road, was a good example of blurring the distinctions between speech and song.
Absolutely. And we've tried to find a way of using song in that slightly different way, using singing. I don't want to use the word song, really, because that, again, is loaded with connotations. But using singing in a way that the story, of course, is about Marion, who beguiles little Leo. 12-year-old Leo finds himself staying with his friend Marcus, who is from a class or two higher than he is. Finds himself staying with Marcus and his family for a very hot 3 weeks during the summer of 1900. Sees that he's really instantly recognises he's a fish out of water. Just the way that the Maudsley family behave in this great pile in which they live. And he is sinking, he's drowning, he doesn't know how to behave until Marion, his friend Marcus's older sister, of course beautifully played in the film by Julie Christie, she comes along and beguiles Leo. He's caught in her web, and we had to find a way of doing that. So I've got Marcus singing to Leo quite a lot. They're school chums, they're 12 years old, they have a little sort of language of children. When the adults enter this fray, it becomes very dry. It's very much spoken. But Marion, suddenly when she enters the scene, she sings to Leo. It's like she's sprinkling fairy dust on him. He is utterly charmed by it. And of course he doesn't recognise that she's singing to him, but he just recognises that there's an adult talking to him, I suppose in the way, communicating with him in a way that his peers do, and in a way that no one else does, perhaps apart from his mother. One thing that I should mention is that shadowing 12-year-old Leo through the whole show is 62-year-old Leo, his older self, who sings everything until that moment. So little Leo speaks. Colston, his name is Leo Colston, and we differentiate the two by Leo being called, 12-year-old is called Leo, 62-year-old is called Colston. At the moment when Leo decides to play adult games and he sings that moment, Colston suddenly speaks. Because there's a reversal of roles there. Suddenly, in order to keep the two characters one whole character, I've divided them like that. So it's a very dramatic moment. It's also the first moment that little Leo confronts full on, eye to eye, his older self.
Making these decisions about where there is an elaboration in song are crucial in a drama. Some people like Mr. Sondheim, although he writes songs, doesn't like opera because it elaborates too much in the moment. He wants to move on with the narrative. Where do you stand on this? How elaborate can Richard Taylor get? How elaborate does he want to get?
Well, of course, like any composer, I say that I didn't choose the go-between as an ego vehicle for the composer, Richard Taylor, but of course I enjoy a composer moment, like any composer does, and enjoy going off on one and having a character sing for 5 minutes. This is the sort of story where you can't really do that in order to keep the tension going. Having Colston, 62-year-old Colston, allows me those moments because he is reflecting on what he's seeing. So action can be going on, but Colston is reflecting on the memories of what happened. And so that does allow me a lot of scope for that.
That's a device they couldn't use in the film, or didn't really use in the film.
Absolutely, and couldn't use if this was spoken theatre. You need music to give us that added layer. Yes. That's where we come into our own, really. And that's where I hope that, yes, The Go-Between is a novel, and yes, The Go-Between is a film, but I think this is the third telling of the story, I really hope. I think this has its... It feels very comfortable in its own skin.
The Richard Taylor I've spoken to in the past has always been slightly torn about how much he likes musicals, in fact, or, you know, and I know that you've composed many other forms of music, and the English choral tradition is something which is inescapable for composers in this country. And indeed, the clips I've heard of the chorus writing in this show that. But you can and do write lovely melodies, and you first came to my attention with Whistle Down the Wind, not the ALW version, but the Richard Taylor version, which was full of gorgeous ideas. In this show, there is one song that I'm familiar with already because it's been recorded, and that is Butterfly. That is a classic traditional song, and a beautiful one. Tell us how that fits and whether that is the only example of its kind in the show and why it is.
I think it is the only example of its kind, and it's absolutely there in the novel. It's the first time that L.P. Hartley really allows Colston, who also narrates the novel, he allows him to expand on his thoughts and how he recaptures that feeling that he had and he hasn't had since he was 12 years old, when little Leo is dressed up by Marion in a new suit because he's only brought very warm clothes and it's a very hot summer in Norfolk. And so Marion takes him into Norwich and she buys him a new outfit. And Leo catches sight of himself in a shop window wearing this outfit, and he says, "I felt like a butterfly that just took off." So Leo runs off by himself, leaving Colston to reflect on what is happening and to reflect on that sense of finding his place in the world for the first time. It's absolutely there in the novel, and it felt absolutely right that we allow that moment to have a musical moment on the stage as well.
She was my saviour, miraculous rescuer. She held the key and released from in me the butterfly. On the soft breath of summer I rose like a butterfly. From my shadow I floated, exalted, a butterfly, finding my wings for the very first time. She allowed me to climb. I was somehow set free.
There are a couple of such moments in the show, but no more than that. Because from that moment on, what's notable about Butterfly is it's the only time that everything seems content. It marks the end of the first sort of little chapter, if you like, both on the stage and in the book. And everything seems perfect. And you could end the story there and make it into a very short story, and you would have had a very, very diverting 45 minutes reading that short novel. But, of course, then it unravels.
It's very interesting to me that audiences have such a problem when beautiful ideas, musical ideas, are floating by them all the time. If they don't coalesce into a big song, they sometimes have a real problem in grasping them because they're sort of subliminal, they go by. And this is where we have to change people's perceptions of what to expect in a piece of music theatre.
Well, I think we have to try and teach the audience how to watch our show. And we as composers and theatre makers, for the first 5 minutes of our show, they always say are the most crucial, because you've got to lay down the ground rules to your audience and teach them how to watch it. And woe betide you suddenly change those rules halfway through, because that's when an audience gets, quite rightly, feels like the rug's been pulled from under their feet. So I hope that we very carefully selected what packs into our first 6 or 7 minutes of our show, and I hope that people, as I said earlier, will come out of it not knowing what was sung and not knowing what was spoken,
right,
because they're so involved in the characters.
Yes.
When I did Whistle all those years ago, one of the nicest things that anybody has said as an audience leaving that show was, "I can't remember what was sung and what was spoken. Mm. It all just amounted to an incredibly moving whole." And that's what I want. I don't want people to come out singing the songs. I'm not interested in that.
Yeah.
And there are sometimes when a big tune can be destructive to the story that you're trying to tell. because it can be so weighty and it can be so like it's got spotlights on, so flagged up, that actually it just gets in the way.
I always remember Sondheim, his name keeps coming up, but it does when you're talking about musical theatre.
Inevitably.
When he collaborated with Richard Rodgers, my idol as a melodist, certainly, on Do I Hear a Waltz, and Rodgers kept saying, that's a good song, we need to reprise that in Act Two. And Sondheim said, but why? There's no reason to reprise it in Act Two. And Rodgers said, but it's a good song. And there we have the nub, don't we? It's just two totally different approaches. One from the old Broadway tradition, where the idea is to stop the show with a song. And from the new wave of musical theatre writing, which is to make the narrative work.
Absolutely not. And I've absolutely worked with a writer before who said, on a show before, he said, this character really should sing this. And I said, why? And he said, well, because it would be nice. And I said, but why are they singing it when they can say it in a line? You know, the classic, I love you. It takes three words to say and 5 minutes to sing. Yeah. But just say it. If you can say it, why sing it? And he said, because it's a musical. And it didn't make sense. And Butterfly, actually, speaking of Butterfly, we've always thought that happens 10 minutes into Act One, maybe. And we've always presumed, David and I, that there may possibly be a moment where it can be referenced or something in Act Two or later in the show. And the director, Roger Haynes, has sort of gently kept nudging him. But it's such a lovely song, it would be lovely. So exactly the same thing happened. Yeah. Needless to say, it doesn't ever get a reprieve. It gets hinted at. But it's because that character is never in that state of contentment again.
Don't you understand? Don't you understand? I had to forget to go on. I had to forget to go on. I had to forget. But you're still here. You've always been here.
It's not too late.
Never too late, Leo.
See it through.
Do what you still have time to do.
What you must do.
Richard, what's the instrumentation? You know, I've heard clips for solo piano, but have you elaborated on that for the show?
I was offered, how many players would you like? Would you like 5, 6? You can have a little band. And of course, any composer, it's hard to turn down the offer of extra musicians. But as I really started thinking about it, I thought that actually the sound world that encapsulates this piece, that is absolutely all about Colston's head and about his psyche, is one piano. And I spoke to Roger Haynes, the director, and Michael Pavalka, the designer, and we all sort of jointly came up with the decision that the piano should be central on the stage. It should be right there on the stage, not in a pit. And this piano absolutely represents Colston. And just
so
as
it's a character.
It's the other character on the stage, or rather it's the extension of his character. It's what completes his character. And just as the whole story is set inside his head, it's all about his memory, with all the highs and lows of one man's journey through his life. So that is absolutely musically represented by the single piano.
And lovely connotations too with the period drawing rooms or salons of the time.
Absolutely, you can't escape that. It is absolutely that. We've been very careful to hint at period, hint at 1900 rather than really go fully there. And also it's not a cut down score. It's not a cut down orchestra, you know, sort of piano reduction, if you like. Yeah. If I was to orchestrate this, I'd need 50 players because it's an incredibly florid, very difficult piano score, very pianistic score. And Jonathan Gill, the musical director, is very brilliant at it, I must say. But I think when people hear it, they'll recognise that actually this is fully a piano score, nothing else, and it lives and breathes and is very comfortable within that skin.
Listen what she's singing around. You just stand on the heat and you're
You're not falling short with the go-between of trying to write a conventional musical. You're trying to create something new, aren't you?
Well,
and is that the message you want to send out? What would you say to the people who are going to come and see this show by way of a preparation for the unusual brew that might be on display?
Well, I think it's important to stress that I didn't set out to create something new. I didn't set out to reinvent the wheel. The wheel is doing very nicely, thank you. And what we set out to do was inch our way through this fantastic story and find a way of putting it on the stage in a way that somehow retains the multi-layered aspect of the brilliant novel. And we're still finding that 3 weeks into rehearsals, but, you know, things are still emerging. But I would say to people, it's not to be scared of, in the sense that hopefully we've written a musical that people who don't like musicals will enjoy. And we've written a musical that people who like Ibsen and drama will enjoy. But hopefully those that love musicals and will be packing into the West Yorkshire Playhouse to see Annie at Christmas, hopefully they will still find enough in it to sustain them too. I'm sure they will, because the music is absolutely approachable. It's just not packaged in the way and delivered in the way that they may be used to. You can't spot a song coming from 30 paces. You absolutely can't. They take you by surprise, and you've got to sit on the edge of your seat and take it at the rate that it's delivered. But if you go in with an open mind, I just really hope that you will leave having had hopefully an incredibly emotional evening, because the story is just that. And you will be aware that music has washed over you and added to that evening in the same way as the fantastic movement on the stage and the lighting does. And you will feel nourished from it.
Well, that's what music does, doesn't it? It adds another dimension. I think that's the thing that one... Well, even if it's not sung, even if it's in films or in dramas where it's underscoring, it heightens.
Completely.
And that is the key. Are you going to continue to write musical theatre, do you think? You've always intimated that you want to get away from it, but you keep coming back to it.
Well, I'm hardly prolific. Whistle Down the Wind was, 15 years ago? And here we are talking about the next one. I do things that interest me, and I'm lucky to have a lot of hats. I've had 2 commissions from the Royal Opera House in the last sort of 18 months, which have been fantastic. With opera singers, and I would say that those pieces were absolutely opera.
Tell us, how did they come about? Just tell us a little bit about them.
I was getting quite involved in demystifying composition. I'd been asked by a few opera companies to just go and do a few composition workshops. I just really enjoyed it. I loved breaking down barriers. Then when the Opera House, who always knew that I was a very busy working composer, they wanted someone to write a huge piece last year to mark the opening of their new production park in Purfleet in Essex. They knew I loved composing with mass groups of people. So they said this commission will be twofold. It will be for you to work with anyone you can get your hands on in the area of Purfleet. So I worked with the developers who were putting the roof on the building. I worked with the shopkeepers around the corner. I worked with probably about 500 people. And did lots and lots of composition workshops. We came up with little bits of material, some longer bits of material. A chorus were put together of local singers. Plus we had 12 amazing soloists from Covent Garden.
Do you like that process, working on your feet?
I do.
Evolving all the time.
Well, I do, because composition is a solitary occupation. In its purest form, it's sitting in a room with a pencil and some manuscript paper. And I still do that, and I think I wouldn't be satisfied if I wasn't still given opportunities to do that too. But I love getting out there and sharing it and sharing the process with people. And it also gives me that, hopefully gives me a bit of an understanding about what people perceive of as music. Nearly all of this music is always theatre music in some way, or has some drama attached to it. It's very rarely music for the sake of music. So I wouldn't go out with a string quartet and try and write a new string quartet. But there's always an element of drama associated with it. And that's where I feel I've got something to say and where I can understand and really learn from working with people and knowing what they like to add to drama and what they need from drama. Hopefully that feeds into something like The Go-Between, which is absolutely about me sitting in a room by myself with a pencil and manuscript paper.
Betrays me.